The Year End in Review. The year 1965 will be known as a newsy year here in the Tri-Cities. It was the year of the big stories. Reporters had no trouble finding headline material. So for the next 1 hour, the WGHN News Department reviews some of the major stories of the year. You'll hear the sounds, the voices, the personalities who helped shape the news in the past 365 days as we present The Year in Review. There were two fires that made big news in the area during 1965. Both occurred in Muskegon County. From the fire files, we were able to find these major blazes during the year. February 5th, first one alarm, then another, and firemen raced to downtown Muskegon. WGHN reporter Al DeVries kept us posted during the fire like this.
Muskegon making headlines tonight as downtown Muskegon is engulfed completely in smoke and flames. A large fire has broken out between 2nd and 3rd Streets on Western Avenue, and flames are engulfing Myers Jewelry, the Radium Photo Shop, Bradford Clothing, and the Colonial Gift Shop. Smoke has completely engulfed the downtown area. Additional firefighting units have been called in. The flames can be seen for many miles from downtown Muskegon, and it looks like the damage is going to run quite extensively. Consumers Power has also got their equipment down here trying to keep things under control. Downtown Muskegon traffic has been completely blocked in all the areas. Smoke we can see now from our calling place is billowing way above the Occidental Hotel and flames shooting even atop that. So far, there have been no reported injuries. However, some of the Muskegon firemen have been overcome by smoke. The biggest damage, it looks like it's going to be from the smoke as it is completely taking over most of the buildings on the south side of Western Avenue.
The other major fire of the year occurred at Footport, May 16. Our reporter, Walt Jansiewicz, was on the scene.
A $750,000 fire, fanned by high winds, destroyed the main office building and four adjacent storage buildings of the Lampo Lumber Company and a Cloverleaf restaurant in Footport. The early morning blaze was the second disastrous blaze to hit the Lapo Lumber Company. In 1951, the entire lumber company was destroyed by fire. Fire companies from Footport Township, City of Muskegon, Muskegon Heights, Grand Haven, Ferrisburg, and township fire departments from Muskegon, Grand Haven, Norton, Spring Lake, Eggleston, Crockery, fought the stubborn blaze in an effort to prevent it spreading to a large group of buildings just west of the blaze. Hampering the firefighters was the lack of sufficient water during the early part of the fire. Charles Spencer, on his way to go fishing at 5:45 a.m., noticed a small blaze in the vicinity of a transformer adjacent to one of the storage sheds at the lumber company. He immediately turned in the alarm at the Footport Township Fire Department, only 100 feet away. Unconfirmed reports say that the blaze was caused by lightning striking a transformer. Other early witnesses report the transformer and pole were ablaze when they arrived on the scene. Also hampering the early call for volunteer firefighters was the loss of electrical power at the fire station, thus making it impossible to sound a siren for volunteer firemen. One of the early arrivers at the scene of the blaze was owner Mitchell Lapo, who immediately entered a main office building that was already becoming smoke-filled, and he salvaged all accounts receivable records and hurriedly took one of two cash drawers before he was forced to evacuate the building when it suddenly blazed. Mr. Lapo discovered that he took the wrong cash drawer and estimated that upwards of $2,000 in cash were burned up in the blaze. He managed to salvage most of all the checks. The hero of the blaze was a Lapo employee, Ole Olson, who volunteered to drive a bulldozer into the roaring fire, protected with gloves and a fireman's raincoat and cap, in an effort to drag a safe from the blaze. With firemen spraying him with water, Mr. Olson pulled a safe from the fire. He suffered minor burns about the face. Early Mr. Olson drove four trucks from the buildings in an effort to save them, which he did, of course. About 150 firemen from 11 companies fought the fire all day Sunday. Two lines, 1 1/3 miles long, were laid from Spring Lake to the fire. In addition, fire trucks were continually shuttling back and forth, filling their tanks and returning to the fire. The Fruitport Fire Department does not have enough hose to reach from Spring Lake to the fire. It was 45 minutes before a continuous water supply could be obtained from the lake. The lack of a municipal water system in the village of Fruitport definitely had a bearing on the outcome of the fire. Owner Mitchell Lampo is setting up temporary offices in an adjacent building for an office and will be open Monday. Mr. Lappo did not reveal any immediate plans other than clearing the burned area. Most of the 50 Lappo employees were present to help the fire. Phone service was disrupted in the area for a short time, as was electrical power. The fire attracted hundreds of Sunday drivers, and the police were kept busy rerouting traffic and keeping the road open for the fire truck shuttling back and forth to the lake for water. Hot ashes were blown about the adjacent heavily wooded area, and it was feared that a woods fire might develop. It is fortunate that the high winds were blowing away from the village of Fruitport, or many homes would have been destroyed by the ashes. This is Walt Janswitz reporting from Fruitport.
Before departing from the police beat, one traffic accident is worthy of mentioning in our year-end report. Now, it occurred at the south end of the county, May 5th, and our reporter in Holland, Ray Reitsma, reported the story for us this way.
Two members of the West Ottawa High School track team remain hospitalized in Holland Hospital for injuries received in a car-bus accident late yesterday afternoon. The accident occurred at the U.S. 31 M21 interchange east of Holland when the brakes of a West Ottawa school bus failed as the bus was leaving U.S. 31 coming down the southbound exit ramp. The school bus struck broadside a car driven by 20-year-old Ronnie Jean Jones of Holland, who was traveling west on Michigan 21. After the impact, the bus overturned, ending on its side in the median of the divided highway. Occupants of the bus were evacuated to the rear emergency door. The bus was driven by 27-year-old Carl Von Inns of Holland, who was also coach at West Ottawa High School. He and another coach, Norman Bradaway, and 10 students were taken to Holland Hospital by ambulance. The remaining students were placed in another bus and taken to the hospital to be checked over. The driver of the car was not injured. The two track team members who were admitted at the Holland Hospital are 18-year-old Daniel Arizmendez, who has received a concussion, and 18-year-old Forrest Hamilton with possible internal injuries. Hospital attendants say Arizmendez is in fair condition and Hamilton is in good condition. West Ottawa Superintendent of Schools, Lloyd Minolfi, said the team was en route to a track meet at Grand Rapids. Ottawa County Sheriff officers say that the two straps leading or holding the bus's exhaust pipe had broken, causing the exhaust pipe to make contact with the brake line leading to the rear wheel and causing the line to burn through. Superintendent Benralty said the bus had only recently undergone an extensive safety check. Three students told this reporter at the scene that the brakes were holding as the bus started down the exit ramp, but that suddenly the bus shot ahead. Reports are that the bus is a total loss. Reports on a number of students which were in the bus are conflicting. However, hospital attendants say that 50 persons were treated. Attendants say, surprisingly enough, though, no sutures were required. Initial examination also indicates there were no fractures. Personnel at the hospital say that this is the largest number that they can recall to have been brought in from a single accident for emergency treatment. The accident occurred at 4:41 p.m. during rush hour traffic and caused a considerable traffic tie-up. This is Ray Reitsma from Holland for WGHN News.
In the lighter side of the news, Grand Haven went all out to welcome the Netherlands Prince Bernard as he passed through our town on his way to Holland, where he was to dedicate a new imported Dutch windmill. It was April 9th when he visited West Michigan.
Your Highness, on behalf of your many admirers here in the Grand Haven area, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to present to you a couple of gifts. The first is an honorary certificate of citizenship in the city of Grand Haven, we shall place it high on our sacred and honored list. And to present you something else, we hope you'll enjoy, the President of the Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Poole.
As President of the Chamber of Commerce of Grand Haven, Spring Lake, and Ferrisburg, it is my privilege to present to you the steer hide rug, which is made in Grand Haven, and we hope will warm your hearth and heart.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for coming to our
Mr.
city.
Mr. Mayor and Mr. President, Chamber of Commerce, Mayor, thank you very much for this wonderful welcome. I didn't know I had so many admirers here, but I'm certainly glad to see them. And I'm deeply moved and grateful for this welcome and for your gifts. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
I'll treasure the honorary citizenship, too.
Thank you. Fine. Okay.
Schools made big news in Grand Haven.
School days, dear old golden rule days.
Yes, the local public school system put into operation a beautiful new junior high school built at a cost of $1 million. And football fans were pleased in the fall of 65 when a brand new concrete stadium was dedicated at Green Hill Field during the halftime of the first game of the season. Athletic Director Steve Sluka presided.
Good evening, football fans. This is a night that I've been looking for a long time, and I think you people have been doing the same thing. We have a nice place to sit. At this time, I would like to introduce Mr. Jacob Punstein, the president of our Board of Education, and also Mr. John Vandermeiden, who is the architect from Vandermeiden Cotellus Architectural Firm. They will perform the next ceremony.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, a few pertinent facts about this stadium. To start with, I would defy anybody to fall through this stadium. Secondly, I'm sure this stadium cannot collapse. The stadium will clean easily because we have hose bibs at the top to wash it down. It'll be low in maintenance because the seat boards are all treated, the brackets are all plated. The wind will not whistle through you. There will very seldom be traffic in front of you. I would like to thank the Board of Education and the Superintendent of Schools for their faith in our firm being able to produce this for less cost than steel bleachers would cost. It is now my privilege to turn over some sort of a key to Judge Jacob Punstein, the president of the school board.
Thank you, Mr. Vandermeiden. On behalf of the students in our school district, the administration and faculty, the Board of Education, and the citizens of the Grand Haven School District, it is an honor and privilege to accept this fine stadium. May all of us in this school district endeavor to maintain not only high academic and moral standards, but also that type of clean, competitive sports which will result in our boys and girls having strong bodies, clean minds and wholesome attitudes, and becoming good American citizens. Thank you very much.
'65 was also a big year for the Grand Haven Christian School. The big date was September 22nd, and the morning after the big event, WGHN carried this story.
More than 200 supporters of Christian education in the Tri-Cities turned out last night for a special ceremony at the Grand Haven Christian School. It was the first meeting of the season for the Christian School PTA. But one segment of the session was historical. First, former school board member Abram Boltice recalled the history of Christian education in Grand Haven and concluded with this statement.
To look back is to stand in wonder at the advances made. It is to be convinced of God's faithfulness. We should make an honest confession here of mistakes and failures, and we should look forward to God's help in the future.
Then school board president Kenneth Poole took over and commented briefly on these matters.
It was about 17 years ago that the first action was taken to launch a new building program. And at that time, we were holding classes in our former building on Columbus Street. And it was in 1948 that the school society, through the Unicircle, decided to purchase the five-acre site that is now occupied by our present facilities. The following year, the school board was authorized to sell the old building and to proceed with plans for a new school. And ground for the new building was broken on September 6, 1950, almost 15 years ago to this day. The board is pleased to announce that we are now able to liquidate the indebtedness on our school building. During the preparation of the program, an interesting fact has been uncovered. As mentioned earlier, the Unicircle, that hard-working ladies group, pledged themselves to raise funds for the initial purchase of the five-acre tract of land. It is this same Unicircle who is now prepared to turn over a sizable check to the school board treasurer, enabling us to pay off the last indebtedness on this school. At this time, I'd like to call our school board treasurer, Mr. Bob Spuma, who has in his possession the last outstanding note on this school building. I would also like to ask Mrs. Steve Klopp, who is the present treasurer of the Unicircle, to come forward, and she has the check to present to the treasurer and the amount of, I'll let her say the amount.
On behalf of the Unicircle, I wish to turn this check over of $1,500 to the treasurer of the school board for the final payment.
I'm sure Bob has in his possession the last mortgage bond on this school.
Finally came the burning of the mortgage. President Poole struck the match as school board treasurer Bob Spuma held the mortgage. And Poole concluded,
"This is the last action signifying the final indebtedness on the school has now been liquidated."
It was a milestone in the history of Christian education in the Tri-Cities. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
The old Ottawa County Courthouse in Grand Haven was replaced in 1965. Ottawa County officers now occupy quarters in a brand new county building at Washington and 4th Street. Dedication ceremonies were held at the new building on September 29th and were broadcast live on WGHN. This is how the story was reported.
Grand Haven High School marching band triggered dedication ceremonies held yesterday afternoon. Following the musical selection, the colors were presented by the Holland VFW Post, and the invocation was given by the Reverend Albert Manson of Jamestown Reformed Church. The senior member of the County Board of Supervisors, Henry Slaughter of Lamont, was the master of ceremonies. He made opening remarks along with Chairman of the Board of Supervisors, Richard Cook of Grand Haven, former Chairman Robert Murray of Coopersville, the Chairman of the Improvement Committee, Herman Windemuller of Park Township, and William Coop of Holland, who was on the dedication committee. The main address was delivered by one of the Grand Haven supervisors, City Attorney Howard Fant, who made this point.
It may well come to pass that this county building will be one of the last great acts of public service by our County Board of Supervisors as we know it today. If this should prove to be true, I can only hope that this county building will remain forever in the memory of the present and future generations of our county community as a monument to the unselfish public service and devotion of the Board of Supervisors to the welfare and to the service of the citizens of this county.
Then John Vandermeiden of the Grand Haven architectural firm of Vandermeiden and Cotellus presented the keys of the building to Supervisor's Chairman Cook.
Mr. Cook, it's a privilege to give you the keys to the new Ottawa County building. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Brief closing remarks were made by the president of the Osterenk Construction Company of Grand Rapids, Ottawa County's two state representatives, and other guests and dignitaries. Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
Still another new building was dedicated in 1965, this in Spring Lake Township. WGHN, of course, was there again. And this is how Doug Chapkus reported that story.
Spring Lake Township's new $81,000 Township Hall has been formally dedicated. Spring Lake Area Boy Scouts raised the flag while the Spring Lake High School Band played the national anthem shortly after 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon to start the ceremonies. Pastor J.R. McDonald of the First Baptist Church of Spring Lake offered the invocation. The chairman of the dedication committee, Neil Van Leeuwen, introduced several special guests. These included State Senator from the 23rd District, Harold Volkema of Holland, State Representative from the 95th District, Melvin DeStichter of Hudsonville, Spring Lake Village President Dr. R.J. Camper, Ferrisburg Mayor Gene Babcock, Spring Lake Library Board Chairman Mrs. Barbara Jean Grandy, Spring Lake Fire Chief Edward Coster, and R.J. Kreisinger. Michael Cotellus of the architectural firm of Vandermeiden and Cotellus made formal presentation of the new building to Spring Lake Township Supervisor Garrett Bottoma.
Yeah, I take great pleasure in giving these keys, Mr. Bottoma, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Cotellus, and I wish to express the appreciation of the Township Board and the people for the excellent job you did in designing this building and also to the builder who built it. We are most happily pleased.
Thank you.
Bottoma then made the dedication address. Following the closing remarks, Chairman Neil Van Leeuwen announced that the building was formally dedicated. Refreshments were then served and open house was held. More than 100 persons attended the special program.
Buildings weren't the only things dedicated in the past year, however. One dedication took place just this past fall on Highway M-104. It was a cold, blustery, rainy day, and the ceremonies were cut to the very minimum. Nevertheless, on that day in November, motorists in the Tri-Cities had good reason to rejoice. The Jackknife Bridge had been replaced with a new Basco Bridge. Ceremonies on the bridge were sponsored by the Tri-Cities Chamber of Commerce, along with the governmental units of the Tri-Cities. Local and state dignitaries were on hand. It was too cold and rainy to do much talking, so within a matter of moments, M.C. Claude Burdine called on the major job contractor, L.W. Lamb, to turn over the bridge to former Ottawa County Road Commissioner Manager Henrik Stapsis, who is now a deputy director of the State Highway Department.
I had a speech prepared, and I was going to give it, but I know how you all feel. You want to get this bridge open, and you want to get out of here. I only want to say that I'm very thankful to get this opportunity for thanking the people of Spring Lake, Ferriesville, and Grand Haven for the very fine cooperation that we've had all through this job, and to please, in the little time that we are left here this fall and again next spring, when you're driving through and we're still working on this bridge, watch the flagman and be very careful, because we will have accidents if you don't, and we'd like to keep our care record, which we've held for 10 years. And is Hank Stassett here for me to give it? Oh, Hank, I've been looking all over for it. Have you brought a final certified check over for the $50,000 that the State Highway still owes me before you get this presented to them?
That'll come in the mail.
That'll come in the mail? All right, then, Hank, the bridge is yours.
The Grand Haven J.C.'s, by far the most aggressive and progressive young men's organization in the community, undertook many projects with great success. One of the most recent is the Beacon Boulevard Park project, about which you will be hearing plenty of in the year to come. One of the fine accomplishments of 1965, however, was the donation and installation of a new intercommunication system in the Grand Haven Municipal Hospital. It was last February when the presentation was made.
On behalf of the Grand Haven JCs, I would like to present this intercommunication system to the hospital via Mr. Tarr and Dr. Prisan, and we've worked on this a considerable length of time, and it is an intercommunication system. This is a communication system between. We had some intercommunication with ourselves while installing this, and we've all worked hard. Mr. Tarr has worked hard, Bernie Boink, and Bill Lucas, my co-chairman. About 250 man-hours has went into putting this communication system in. And we're sure that communications in the hospital are going to be a little better. With that, we would like to present this communication system to the hospital.
Thank you, Mr. Blanchard, Mr. Fochtman, Mr. Boonstra. It certainly is a wonderful contribution that you've made here for our hospital. The system itself has taken a great deal of work, and we owe a lot to the JCs, to Mr. Boink, Mr. Bernard Boink, for his supervision and for the help that he gave us in getting the equipment. It's my understanding that we have about a $4,000 project here, which couldn't have been gotten any other way than by volunteer help to the JCs.
I just want to say amen to what Mr. Tarr has said. I think this is another wonderful achievement on behalf of the Tri-Cities JCs, and I think that the benefit that the citizens of Grand Haven will derive will be many over the many years from this fine intercommunication system. And I think this is another example where the people who have put themselves out a little bit for the benefit of others is a fine example of the cooperation we have in the Tri-City area. You're to be congratulated, all of you.
And now, here are the stories of the year. The WGHN News Department has selected two stories as the major newsmakers of 1965, one of an unpleasant nature, the other most pleasant. The first is the story of the Gardner Denver Company strike in Grand Haven, a strike that began back in November of 1964. It was a bitter strike, a strike that seemingly would never be settled because of strong positions maintained by both company and the union. The union local, Lodge 1503 of the International Association of Machinists, sought a full union shop. The company refused to grant it. Both sides eventually worked themselves into positions, allowing little room for compromise. And so the strike lingered on and on and on. It would be impossible to list all of the peak moments of the strike, some good, some bad. It was January 22, 1965, when the first major violence erupted. Two cars were overturned at the Gardner Denver plant by angry strikers on that day, and the president of the local, when contacted for his reaction to the incidents, Frank Radakovich, issued a statement to WGHN, which later was to be quoted many times.
These are, I would say, the voice of labor talking at this point.
In February, the Greater Grand Haven Ministerial Association called a day of prayer on behalf of both sides in the strike, seeking divine guidance for a quick end to it. Vice President of the Clergymen, Pastor J.R. McDonald of Spring Lake, gave us this statement at that time.
The intent is simply to make this needy matter before God in prayer. The specific request of God would be for him to work in the hearts of men in the leadership. For these men to once again, before God, search their own hearts and minds relative to their own positions, to make sure that maintaining their present position is not being done in rancor or personal prejudices. It is further desired that God will help these men to seek fair and forthright means of mediating this affair.
On June 10, 1965, a major labor demonstration is held in Grand Haven. All union members of the area joined forces to make the day a huge success. It was a day of parades, speeches, and sit-ins. Doug Chapkis reports from the scene during the morning demonstrations.
Union members walked off their jobs in and around the Tri-Cities this forenoon to participate in a sympathy walk here in front of the Gardner Denver plant in Grand Haven. The members of the various union locals are demonstrating their support of Local Lodge 1503 of the International Association of Machinists in its fight against the Gardner Denver Company for a union shop in this plant. The full union shop has remained the main issue throughout the strike, now in its 32nd week. According to our estimates, more than 1,000 people are now on the scene so far. The demonstration has been relatively orderly. The group is now marching around the plant and have been quite orderly in this respect. Police arrived at the scene prepared for anything, however. There were 14 Grand Haven City police officers on hand and some state policemen, including Sergeant Arthur Baker, commander of the local post, and Captain Leroy Hunt, commander of the 6th District. Chief Richard Klempel of the City Police Department was also on hand. All police are wearing what are commonly called hard hats, the regular helmets, and are also carrying nightsticks. At about 10:55, all company employees were evacuated by apparently company management, and this met with unpleasant results as far as the attitude of the group here. This continued quite orderly until very near the end of the line of cars as it left the plant. The final car to leave was that of Bryce Maddox, the plant general manager. Mr. Maddox was alone in the car driving, and this enraged the strikers to some extent. They began to rock the car, and it appeared as though they might try to tip it over. However, police successfully steered him through the wild crowd that completely circled the car. The demonstration today is believed a result of the company's recently revealed policy of hiring new blue-collar factory workers to keep up production in the plant during the strike. The union on strike, Local 1503, immediately rebelled at this, said it could lead to possible violence and bloodshed, that it merely prolonged the strike. Henry Van Heese, president of the North Ottawa Labor Council, said he figured there were probably some 2,500 union workers in the area, said he didn't figure that nearly that amount would turn out, but it does appear that 1,000 to 1,500 so far have turned out. The group is now, as we mentioned, circling the plant. There are many signs of the many unions represented here, some even from Grand Rapids, and it's reported some from Muskegon, although these we have not seen. We also have seen a sign in the front of a plant against the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. The pickets are claiming now that the life insurance company has withdrawn its support of the strikers. They no longer have their insurance through them. Well, that's all for now from the scene at the Gardner Denver plant. This is Doug Chapkis reporting from Victor's Grocery Store across the street from the Gardner Denver plant on Fulton Street.
North Ottawa Central Labor Council President Henry Van Heese was pleased with the demonstration.
Hello, this is Henry Van Heese, President of the Central Labor Council of North Ottawa County. We wish at this time to say that this protest march that happened this morning was one of the most successful that ever happened in the city of Grand Haven. We hope that people in Grand Haven will recognize labor that we are a people working for a living, and that we would like to also see this Gardner-Denver Local 1503 union strike get settled. This strike is setting a bad labor picture in the city of Grand Haven, and we would like to see it settled. The citizens in this town would like to see it settled for the interest of Grand Haven, the families, the storekeepers, the Ministerial Association, and we are sure that with cooperation between citizens, public officials, union officials, management officials, I think that we can get this settled. I would also at this time like to thank all managements for giving permission for all union labor to be able to participate in this demonstration. We also would like to thank WGHN at this time for their cooperation in presenting this news. I thank you.
The general manager of the Grand Haven Gardner-Denver plant, Bryce Maddox, wasn't quite as pleased.
I think it's a great shame that certain of the strikers and those who support them, whether they're right or wrong, have engaged in the kind of activities which have been witnessed on the picket line in the last few days. Such things as name-calling, spitting, vile language, and obscene behavior are not a credit to any decent person, but they are a demonstration of a complete lack of self-respect. I hope those kinds of activities will arouse this community so that the good citizens will use their efforts not to persuade anyone to a particular point of view, but to use reason and legal order in pursuing their ends. Now, I, too, believe in the voice of labor, but I think that term is being used by certain people for their own selfish and ambitious purposes and in such a way as to degrade this community and to get nationwide publicity of the most despicable sort.
There were injunctions, arrests, court action, the works, but the strike continued on. June 25th, 1965, two sticks of dynamite thrown onto the roof of the Gardner-Denver plant. The early morning blast was heard over the entire city and followed an earlier incident of less serious-minded vandals who tossed Molotov cocktails at the plant. This time, Mayor William Creason was concerned, and he issued this statement.
The city is sad to learn of the tragic accident at the Gardner-Denver plant last night. This type of behavior seems to be a continuation of some irresponsible group or individual who seems to feel that they can take over and completely disregard law and order. The city government is not taking sides in this dispute between the company and the union, but the city intends to insist that law and order be maintained. The city government is interested in bringing to justice any person or persons responsible for any act of violence which has occurred or may be perpetuated in the future. We have therefore requested and received more state police protection to serve the area, and I say that if any citizen knows of any leads that might be of assistance in bringing to justice those who have been engaged in these unlawful acts, I hope they will please notify the police department.
Gradually, the strike faded from the news. Things didn't improve, but they didn't get any worse. The company hired new employees and the wives of office workers, and the union members began getting jobs at other plants. And then what seemed to be just another routine meeting was called for the union to be held at Grand Haven's Polish Falcon Hall, September 14th. But the meeting turned out to be a historic one. Bruce Wilson, an aide to Union International Vice President Floyd Smith, took charge of the meeting. He read a letter announcing that Local 1503 had been placed in trusteeship and its officers suspended from duty. He then announced that agreement had been reached with the company on a new contract and that the strike was over. Well, as you might imagine, pandemonium broke loose. Some were very, very angry. Some were very, very glad. But after more than 10 months, the Gardner-Denver strike was over. When the strike was formally announced as being terminated, Mayor Creason issued this statement.
The long strike of the Gardner-Denver Company has been a serious and difficult problem for our community. We hope now that a solution
has been found, that we can rebuild our enthusiasm and fine community spirit for which the Grand Haven area has been so well known.
And the chairman of the State Labor Mediation Board, Robert Howlett, said this.
The members of the Michigan Labor Mediation Board and the mediators who have worked on the Gardner-Denver machinist dispute are most gratified that the issues separating the parties have been resolved. We are delighted that Mr. Roy Seemuller, international president of the machinists, and Mr. Cedric Riemann, president of the Gardner-Denver company, were able to come to an agreement and thus settle this 10-month-old dispute.
It was an unpleasant chapter of local history, and it'll be many years before all the memories and the sad times can be erased and replaced with better feelings. But it was very real, and we did have to report the news. The other award winner for Tops in the News was a much more pleasant story, a story of a gift, of a will to improve, and of a community effort that impressed many other communities. It was the story of a proposed new library and community building that will become a reality in the city of Grand Haven. Now, this story began officially in our Grand Haven City Council meeting on June 7th. The next morning, Doug Chapkus took almost an entire newscast to break the good news to the community.
The city of Grand Haven has received the largest gift in its history, a brand new public library, completely furnished. But the story actually goes back to September of 1963, when Mayor William Creason appointed a 24-member committee headed by Eugene Harbeck, Jr., to review the report of a library consultant and make whatever recommendations it felt necessary. Harbeck presented the recommendations on behalf of the committee last night to the city council. He stated the library consultant, Robert Orr, had made a study which indicated present facilities were inadequate, and a new library was needed to serve the greater Tri-Cities area for the next 50 years. After a 2-year study by his overall committee, Harbeck said the group made the following recommendations upon the specific charge of Mayor Creason. On the best way of governing the administration of a new library.
The committee recommends a Grand Haven Public Library with contracts available to outlying areas as the most practical approach to the administration of a library facility.
On where the new library should be located.
The committee then unanimously agreed that the site already owned by the Lauder Foundation would be the most appropriate and desirable location for the library cultural facility. The site owned by the Lauder Foundation between 4th and 5th on Columbus and directly across from Central Park.
The committee, working with library consultants Morehart and Uveling of the Detroit Public Library and the architectural firm of Jickling and Lyman of Birmingham, then came up with a new approach to the mayor's suggestion on exploring various possibilities for a multipurpose library. Instead, it was felt a separate library and a separate cultural center would be better.
Our architects prepared a questionnaire to guide our plan of action, and after some refining and guidance from our architectural firm, it was agreed that a need for such a cultural facility does exist in the Tri-Cities area, and that it would be a mistake in the long-range planning to house both a library and a cultural facility under the same roof. The site selected has room for two buildings, and our architects demonstrated that the two facilities would complement each other and offered a comprehensive program for the area. Further meetings with the architects refined the program as to space relationships, from which came the detailed blueprints submitted with this report.
Harbeck said the committee came up with these cost estimates.
If you wanted to then allocate all of the costs to the separate buildings, without this artwork and site work and demolition as a separate item, you would come up with a library costing $716,700, a community artwork of $451,700, or a total project of $1,168,400. And so in round dollars, you're talking around $720,000 for the library, $410,000 for the $451,000 for the community arts building.
He said funds could probably be raised by a campaign, contributions, a bond issue, through urban redevelopment, or through the Library Services and Construction Act. He added that the committee felt operational expenses could be met by a combination of any or all of several methods suggested. And Harbeck concluded this way.
If at all possible, we would recommend the construction of both buildings simultaneously. If this is not economically feasible, the immediate goal, although both buildings serve important purposes, would be the library building. We therefore commend the entire program to both the council and the community. Number two, because the program will be of extreme interest and benefit for all persons in the area, and not just in Grand Haven, we are hopeful that the necessary contractual arrangements based on equitable cost factors can be agreed upon to the mutual satisfaction of all. Number three, the program as developed is flexible enough to provide expansion possibilities in the future, and is multi-purpose enough in its nature to provide spaces for a number of groups in existence today and for those which might develop in the future. And number four, we believe that the City of Grand Haven can afford the additional millage required to operate these facilities. It is well known that a library is not of itself a substantial revenue-producing organization, but in today's complex world, knowledge is essential for survival. In the community arts building, the possibilities for revenue to at least cover costs are greater than in the library, and we believe that the city should make the rooms available to interested groups on some standard fee basis. Number five, we believe that the addition of these two buildings will make the City of Grand Haven and the outlying areas a much more satisfying place in which to live. I could also aid in attracting new industries and people to our area because they would show that we are indeed interested in culture and the arts. Our study has shown that a need for this program truly exists. Plans for such a development on a beautiful site should excite each one of us. Now let us advance as rapidly as possible so that today's dreams may become tomorrow's reality.
In other words, the committee recommended construction of a new library and a new community arts building simultaneously at an estimated cost of about $1,170,000. He explained that this did not include the cost of the site, since the Laudit Foundation had agreed to furnish the site on Columbus, bounded by 4th and 5th Streets. He added that the foundation also had agreed to pay the costs of consultants and architects. Mayor Cresson thanked the Laudit Foundation, and that's when Paul Johnson, foundation president, rose to read a letter from the foundation to the council.
The trustees of the Laudit Foundation have studied the report of the Library Study Committee now before the city council. The program is outlined in this report. Will be of great benefit to the citizens of Grand Haven and the surrounding area. To assist in the realization of this program, the trustees of the Laudit Foundation have voted to submit the following proposal to the City Council and the citizens of Grand Haven. Number one, the Laudit Foundation will erect and furnish the library in accordance with the design contained in the report of the Library Study Committee at an estimated cost of $725,000. Number two, in case the bids for construction of the library exceed the estimates as contained in the report, the Laudit Foundation reserves the right to reject the bids and request the assistance of the Library Study Committee in reconsidering the design of the building. Number three, upon completion of the library, The building together with the land now owned by the foundation on Columbus Street between 4th and 5th Streets will be given to the City of Grand Haven at no cost to the community. This property has been purchased by the Lot Foundation during the past 3 years at a cost of $135,000. Number four, to assist in meeting the increased operating cost of the library, the foundation will, over a period of 5 years, contribute to the library operating fund a total of $80,000 on the following schedule. The first year, $25,000. The second year, $20,000. The third year, $15,000. The fourth year, $10,000. And the fifth year, $10,000. It is the sincere hope of the trustees of the Lotta Foundation, the City Council, and the citizens of Grand Haven will proceed with the balance of the program recommended by the Library Study Committee and complete the erection of the Community Arts Building in the near future. Whether or not this is possible, the Lotta Foundation is prepared to proceed with the erection of the library upon receipt and acceptance of this proposal contained in this letter and the assurance of the City Council that the size and type of library proposed by the Library Study Committee is acceptable to the City Council and, in their opinion, meets the future needs of the community for a public library.
And Mayor Pison replied,
and I can very quickly and very happy and feel very privileged to say that on behalf of the City Council we accept this generous gift, and I'm sure that it will enrich the lives of the citizens of this area for many years to come. Needless to say, this is the largest gift that's ever been given to the City of Grand Haven, and I can assure you that the citizens will be busting with pride when they drive by and see it. And I want to thank you for making it possible. It's an awful lot to digest in one evening. The food is so rich. The council has not, we did receive this report a couple of days ago, the council has not had a chance to decide what it was going to do with the various recommendations and what has happened this evening. I don't know what the outcome will be, but I can assure you that we will study all avenues and all approaches to utilize this generous offer, and if it's possible, to use the realization of the complete building in time.
Doug Chapkus, WGHN News.
The next day, Mayor Creason made this statement.
The gracious gift of the trustees of the Lotta Foundation, I'm sure, will enrich the lives and the minds of the people of this area for many years to come. This is certainly a most generous gift, the most generous gift ever given to the city, and it is to be used for a most important purpose. Civilization throughout history has been judged by its cultural and educational achievements. Just so is a community judged, and great is that community in which one must extend the yardstick as he measures the cultural and educational opportunities offered its citizens. In addition, other developments will result from this fine beginning, such as area redevelopment and revitalization. The beautiful setting of Central Park, I'm sure, will take on new interest and use by the activity that will encircle it in the future. The improvement possibilities for beautification and utilization of the area are many. I'm certain there will be more to come. I sincerely hope that the citizens will read the report and study the model and the plans, and then they will show with the council and the Area Library Study Committee their enthusiasm and desire to see the total project to completion. This wonderful gift will enable the Grand Haven area to move forward in the cultural realm. We certainly are most appreciative.
But, of course, there was much work yet to be done. A successful fundraising drive was staged, netting more than $200,000 towards half the cost of the new community building. Then it was up to the voters in Grand Haven whether they'd agree to a bond issue for the remaining $200,000. And the voters came through. On November 9, 1965, they overwhelmingly stamped their approval on the proposal. And again, an enthused and grateful Mayor Creason issued a public statement.
I would like to take this opportunity on behalf of the City Council to thank Mr. Marion Sherwood, Chairman, and Mr. Ed Ellis, the Executive Director, and the members of the committee who worked so hard to bring the facts about the community center before the citizens of Grand Haven. I also would like to take the opportunity to thank the news media, who I think did an outstanding public service in this endeavor. In fact, indeed, this has been a wonderful community action project. When almost 68% of those people voting are in favor of raising their taxes to improve and make their community a better place to live, to
to offer its future citizens as well as those present more facilities in which to utilize their free time productively. This truly is wonderful. I would also like to thank all those who contributed monetary pledges for the first phase of this program. This was an area effort and shows again we can do it in the Tri-City area. Once again, people will look at Grand Haven and say, there is a fine, outstanding, progressive community. The future is certainly full of some exciting, challenging opportunities for this area, and I'm mighty proud to be a part of this community.
This story will unquestionably have long-range benefits and effects on the community, and is undoubtedly the story of the year, 1965. And so another year has passed. There were many more great news stories, the reporting of which time just doesn't allow. But another year is here, and the stories that count are the stories still to come. And chances are they'll be better, and they'll tell of even greater things for the community, because of a group of people who live in an area called the Tri-Cities, and who are willing to work and sweat and pull together through thick and thin for the betterment of all. This has been the Year in Review, a wrap-up of the major news stories of 1965 in and around this area. The Year in Review was written and produced by the WGHN News Department under the direction of Doug Chapkis. Portions of the preceding program were pre-recorded.